Now, WBS, Work Breakdown Structure Applications. Now, the first is the application of WBS are as varied as the approaches to it. Now, some organizations use it strictly for work definition. What do? They decompose the complete project into smaller logical units and or deliverables or tasks or into their parts and subparts. As the WBS is being broken down into different levels, its applications at those levels might vary. And because different organizations break down the WBS in different ways, they could be primarily task-based or product-based categories, the approaches may lead to different applications and different methods by which WBS is used in the organization. So WBS may be applied in the requirements definition by defining the deliverables from the macro to the micro, until the individual components of the deliverable are clearly delineated and are logically separate from each other. Now, key question in the WBS is, when do I stop further subdivision of work into further smaller elements? Now, there are several rules of the thumb to use over here. The first one is called the 80-hour rule, which means no single activity or group of activities to produce a single deliverable should exceed 80 hours of collective effort. So the smallest element should have a collective 80 man hours of collective effort. The second rule of thumb is that no activity or series of activity should be longer than a single reporting period. So if the reviews are to be held monthly, the smallest element of work should also be completed in 1 month's time. The third rule is, if it makes sense rule. In this, common sense is used to judge if the duration of the activity or the series of activity would logically produce the deliverable defined by the WBS, or do we need to break this down further to make it easier, simpler and faster. The fourth one is the work package. This is the activity at the task level. Now, this can be realistically and confidently measured. This should be realistically and confidently measured, should and makes no sense to further subdivide the task, can be completed in one or, you know, rule of thumb as described earlier, produces a deliverable output which is measurable and understood by the other people, and forms a unique package of work which can either be outsourced or contracted out or given to another vendor. So this is how WBS work packages should work in reality. Let's look at the 10-step process flow that we are going to use or which is used to determine what is the project charter. So the first thing is to understand or to define the work. And the second one is to build the work plan and the budget. The third one is to manage the complete project plan and the budget, consisting of issues, scope of work, how are we going to communicate within the team and to the customer and the user. Seventh is a risk that is involved. Eight is the documentation. Nine, what is the quality that we are looking at from the project? And 10, what is the metrics that we are going to use to measure the success of the project? So to elaborate this in a lot more detail, let us look at the project charter. Now, the project charter by definition is a document which embodies the project goals and the commitment to the stakeholders to the project and all its outcomes. What does the project charter include? The first one, it includes the project title prepared by the name of the person who's made it, the date on which it is prepared, and there's a version control on the project charter trying to control the number of iterations the project may have possibly gone through in the past. Okay? That's the first thing. The second thing is the project charter will contain the background of the project. It will outline the current situation and determine where you are right now vis-a-vis the project. The second thing the project charter this will create is, where will the project take you? So in terms of competitive advantage or in terms of market position or in terms of strength or in terms of wallet share with the customer, where are you right now and where will this project take you? The third thing is, what are the key benefits that this project will deliver to you as a user? The fourth thing is the aims and objectives. So it clearly defines what the project is aiming to achieve. Two, The aims and objectives should be as clear, as precise, and as specific as you can think of it. The more clear you are, the more specific you are, the better output you will get from the project. All aims and objectives should follow SMART norms. We discussed SMART norms. They should be specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time-bound. So they should follow these SMART norms. The next thing that the project charter should contain is the criteria of success. How will we know that this project has been a success for us or not been a success for us? So the criteria for success or the methodology of measuring the success of the project should be spelled out in advance. That will clearly determine what benchmark number will the project achieve that we will say is a success for us. The next thing that the project charter should contain is the consequences of failure. Now, this focuses on the downside of the project. Normally, we don't want the project to fail, but barring unforeseen circumstances, should the project fail and does not meet its objective, what will be the consequence of failure on the organization, on the organization's financial condition, and on the organization's future position in the market? The next important part of the project charter is the assumptions. Now, every project, whenever it is designed, works with a set of certain data that we have collected in the past and certain forecasts that we have made for the future and certain areas that remain gray areas of which we neither have a forecast nor do we have past data are defined on the basis of assumptions. Every assumption that we make in the project should be clearly laid out and articulated. Normally, we fail to put the assumptions in writing, and therefore, when the project is being read or evaluated later, the assumptions underlying the project are not clearly understood. If the issue with not writing them down is, if they go unsaid, they are unnoticed. Now, because they remain unnoticed, they may possibly give us a clue if there is a failure in the project for some reason. Related to assumptions, we also have constraints. We should clearly be able to write down under what constraints this project is being undertaken. So, what factors will limit the project or allow us not to develop the project to its fullest extent, and what impact will it have on our company? Clearly, it is important to clearly identify all the factors impacting a plan and what are the steps we have taken to accommodate them or live with them. The next part of the project charter is a risk analysis. Every project has a certain number of risks for the organization. So what are the risks? A list of all the risks. Then classifying those risks as very critical, moderately critical, and of no consequence or low consequence. One should list out all and consider their probability and potential impact on our plans. We should also know or also learn, also put in writing in, as a part of the project charter, how will we know where the risk has come in and how do we backtrack to try and identify the warning signals in advance to prevent the risk from happening. And finally, what will be the risk mitigation plan in case a risk comes and blows up in our face. So there has to be an identification of the risk mitigation plan. The next thing is contingency plan. We make a plan, none of the plans ever go as per plan. There is always a deviation, there is always a variance. Okay? So what happens if things don't go as scheduled and what are we going to do about it? So what contingencies and safety factors we build into the plan? The next thing that we have to identify as a part of the project charter is the project documentation. It is important to identify the documents related to the project, where they are kept, with whom they will be shared, who are the people who are parties to this document, etc. Typical documents will include the complete project charter, which is the full project report, will include a project plan, which could be a Gantt chart or could be a PERT CPM chart. It could be a method statement by which the project will be implemented. There will be a complete risk analysis document, contingency plans, budgets related to the project, a format for capturing minutes of the meeting related to the project, a quality plan, specifications, and a project contact directory with a list of participants with their mobile numbers and email addresses to be contacted in case you want any further information, details, or some specific area of the project that needs attention to who should we call and contact. All this is an important part of the project charter. In addition to that, the key dates in the project typically identify every key milestone or have every milestone identified with a date, a start date and an end date, detail any key decision points and their deadlines, even identify review dates in the project. The next thing that the project charter should have is the project control methodology. So what is the process for monitoring and controlling the project? What are going to be the reporting structures and the frequency of reviews of the project and updates? Is there an MIS related to the project required? So what will be the MIS? What information about the project should be circulated among the relevant people so that the project is, you know, everybody has their eyes and ears on the deadlines and try achieving them. Now the logic being, if people involved in the project are aware that regular updates are required, they will hopefully be aware of the need to avoid disappointments and pitfalls related to the project. The next thing that the project charter should have is the key project personnel. Identify the key people who will be a part of the project, their background, their skills inventory, and what their roles will be. Their details should be kept in the project contact directory in terms of phone numbers and contact details, phone numbers and email IDs. Okay, so important to have identification of key project people. So this is what a typical project charter should include. Now, every project, we will create a project charter, will have to be evaluated financially. So how do we financially evaluate projects? This is the next part of our discussion, the project financial evaluation of projects. Now, companies may have several projects that they may want to implement, or they may have several software projects that they may want to undertake. How do they decide between various projects, which has a priority and which has a second priority and third priority? Now, typically, this is done by understanding the benefits of the project and the ROI that the project is likely to deliver to the company. Now, methods that are used for financial evaluation include what is called return on investment, ROI. The second method is the payback period. The third one is the net present value method. And the fourth one is the internal rate of return or the IRR method. Let's quickly look at some of the methods that we are using for evaluating the financial returns of the project. The first one, of course, return on investment. Can some of the definitions, possible definitions of return on investment, it could be ROI is equal to operating income divided by the total cost of the project. So, for example, if the company is, you know, investing, 1 crore rupees on the project, and they get, you know, an operating income from that which is around 20 lakhs, then the ROI that the project is delivering is about 20%. Now, ROI can also be defined as profit after tax plus depreciation divided by the investment. So, this is one definition of ROI that could be used. The second definition of ROI that could be used is operating income divided by sales. Or it could be operating income divided by sales multiplied by sales divided by total investment, which means it could be operating income divided by investment. The third method of calculating ROI could be return on sales multiplied by asset turnover ratio. So you can pick and choose which ROI best reflects what your organization is looking for. The second method of evaluating the project financially is called the payback method. Now, the payback method is a method of capital budgeting used to find out the period of time. It is basically analyzes the if you invested a certain amount of money in your project over a period of time, it tries to measure in what period of time will you recover all the costs that you have incurred to implement this project, okay, or to reach break-even point. So, for example, if 1 lakh investment was returned in, which returned 50,000 rupees per year, would have a 2-year payback period. So, you are getting 50,000 for in 2 years, the entire money of 1 lakh is typically returned. Only drawback in this is we have not taken the time value of money. The value of 50,000 rupees this year is not same as the value of 50,000 rupees that we receive next year. Okay, so if we factor that value of money in, we can also calculate the, it might take a little longer time to recover the money. Now, payback period intuitively measures how long something will take to pay for itself. All things being equal, shorter payback periods are preferred by corporates and organizations over longer payback periods. And the payback period is popular because it's easy to use, easy to calculate, and easy to understand, though it may have some limitations which you may read if you are a, or which somebody from finance can fill you in on. So that is the payback period. The third method is called the net present value method. Now, the net present value method is another method of capital budgeting used, is a tool used in discounted cash flow analysis. Now, it is a standard method for using the time value of money to appraise a long-term project. Now, used very widely in the industry, used very widely by a lot of financial professionals throughout economics, finance and accounting, it measures the excess or shortfall of cash flow in present value terms over the cost of funds that you are using to fund this project. NPV can be described as the amount, differential amount between the sums of discounted cash inflow and outflow. So it is a differential. You have a certain amount of cash outflow related to the project and a certain amount of cash inflow related to the project. When you discount this over a period of time and take the, you know, the time value of money into consideration, the difference of that is the net present value. It compares the present value of company to the present value of money in the future, taking inflation and interest into account. So that is the net present value method, which can also be used to evaluate projects. And then, so this is how the NPV is used. If NPV is more than zero, it means that the investment would add value to the firm and the project could possibly be accepted. If the NPV is less than zero, the investment is negative, I mean the return on investment is negative, and this project should be rejected. When NPV is equal to zero, the investment would neither create any gain nor any loss for the company. Now, we should be indifferent in the decision whether to accept or reject a project when NPV is zero. This project is not adding any monetary value to the company or to the organization. Therefore, the decision could be based on other criteria. For example, it gives me access to new customers, or it improves my strategic positioning in the market. Factors that may not be explicitly included in the calculation, nor they may have been explicitly quantified. Then you should use those methods to understand whether you will take up this project or not take up this project. Similarly, a variation of the net present value method is the internal rate of return method. Now, the internal rate of method, IRR on the method, or IRR, or the internal rate of return as a method, is an investment on the project which actually calculates the effective compound rate of return that this project is delivering to us. If the net compound, the rate of return that the project is delivering is higher than your cost of capital, then you are kind of in the right project. If the IRR is less than the cost of capital, then you are likely to lose money over a period of time. Okay? So this is another method that can be used to understand the internal the return that the project is delivering to you over a period of time. Now, IRR calculations are commonly used to determine the viability of investment or projects. Higher the IRR, the more desirable the project is and more profitable the project is. Lower the IRR, less profitable the project is. Assuming all projects require the same upfront amount of money, the project with the highest IRR should be considered the best and taken first. Typically, a company should, in theory, undertake all projects or investments where the IRR exceeds the cost of capital. Now, investment could be limited by the due to availability of the funds to the firm and the firm's capacity or ability to raise funds and manage multiple projects. So, that could be a limitation that you need to work separately on. So, that is, you know, so assessing the return on investment, you could use the following methods. You could do a trend analysis. You could see what the project is delivering year on year and do a trend analysis. You can do a benchmarking of the return on investment with competitors to see how much competitors are making. You can, you know, analyze and compare two competitors and look for signals suggesting where there could be possible problems and fix them or address them in designing the ROI and or doing the ROI analysis of your projects. Now coming to the next element which we must determine is what could be the project goals. Now the project goal, a goal is a statement or the broader level of a concrete activity that the organization or a department or an SBU or a person or a system is going to undertake to achieve or obtain. A desire or an intention becomes a goal if and only if there's an action for achieving it is activated. So, Morton Lind and J. Ramison distinguished three categories of goal related to technological system management. One is a production goal, the second is a safety goal, and the third one is a economic goal. Now, goals have two parts. Typically, they have a business part which articulates a business outcome, and they may have a technology or a solution part which articulates which technology or solution is likely to deliver the above business outcome. Now, technical managers and IT solution architects normally tend to identify with technology solution side of the goal without having a clear awareness of what the business goal is or without the business side of the goal. To ensure that the project will deliver the business or the return on capital or the money that the company requires, someone from the business side will also have to drive the project so that it is balanced on both the business and the technology side. Then the next element is, or the next element of the project is project stakeholders. Now these are people who are involved in the project either directly or indirectly or who will be impacted by the project in some way or the other. Now stakeholders typically tend to have a set of expectations from a project. Now expectations could be in terms of product or service features, could be improvement in quality, could be reduction in cost, could be improvement in output, throughput, product, better features and so on and so forth. If any project, one set of stakeholders will be benefited by the completion of the project, while another set of project stakeholders may lose as a result of the project. So whenever we undertake a new project, we will always have stakeholders who will be positively benefited and stakeholders who may not be positively benefited. It is important to understand and identify who these stakeholders are. It is important to assess and map what the expectations of each of these stakeholders or category of stakeholders are from the project. Which set of stakeholders are likely to win? Which set of stakeholders are likely to lose something due to the project? The problem is not with the people who get something out of the project. The problem is always with the stakeholders who are going to lose something as a result of the project. It is therefore important to understand the stakeholders who will lose something, identify what their losses are, and therefore try to determine in advance what they could do to become a barrier to the project or what will they do to stop the project from happening. Okay? They could become a roadblock in the completion of the project. Therefore, what could be our possible strategy to reduce the impact of the loss these projects can take on the stakeholders and how can we suitably compensate them for this? We should also identify which set of stakeholders would benefit for the project and what could be the possible benefit and what could be the overall cost benefit analysis of this project. In case of conflicting requirements between stakeholders, which requirement should take precedence over the other is very important for us to determine as a part of the project charter. Now, typical stakeholders that could be there in a project could be project sponsor, then project managers, project teams, support staff, customers, users, suppliers, etc. So these could be the possible stakeholders you may find in any typical project. Some of them will benefit, some of them will not benefit from this development that is happening as a result of this project. How do we analyze the stakeholders' requirements? It is important to map the requirements or assess the expectation of all these stakeholders, and one can use the matrix given below. So you can have a stakeholder category: what is his priority, what are his key expectations, what are the benefits he's likely to get, what is the likely loss he's going to get, and what is the risk he represents to the project. So for example, if you want to build a new airport, for the new airport, suppose you require a large amount of land, then people who lose their land are likely to be shareholders or stakeholders who are going to lose their land, and they may, you know, prevent the airport from coming up by not selling their land to you. So you may want to evaluate how to compensate them suitably for the land so that, you know, they do not be a roadblock to the success of your airport project. So this is how you analyze the stakeholder needs. Then the next part of the project charter is the project risk. Any project, any business, anything that we do has a set of risks associated with it. It is important to identify the risks in advance and classify them as low consequence, medium consequence, and high consequence. Okay? It is important to understand what the risks are, how the risks will impact the organization, and what we can do to mitigate those risks. So there is a whole risk in risk analysis that we do for every project. Okay? Now, whether it's a small risk that needs to be dealt with or a risk that may likely to occur in future, both these areas are identified and understood from a risk analysis perspective. Now, typically, project risks management involves, of course, identifying the risk, assessing and analyzing the impact of these risks, classifying them as low priority, medium priority, and high priority, then reducing the uncertainties by understanding and planning for them, what could reduce the impact of the risk by risk mitigation strategy, how could we develop a contingency plan for critical risks, and then constantly monitoring and managing the risk so that we are not taken by shock and surprise when those risks occur in the course of implementing the project. Now, project risk management typically consists of 6 sub-processes. One is risk management planning. What should be the approach to risk management? Then risk identification. What are the risks that this project inherently has in them? Then a qualitative risk analysis, assessing the likelihood, which is the probability of occurrence, and what are the possible outcomes. The quantitative risk analysis, which is computer simulation, decision tree analysis, which is in terms of relative risk, low, medium, high analysis. Then risk response planning, which means what do we do in case a risk occurs and how do we mitigate each risk, then risk monitoring and control. So these are the 6 steps that are typically involved in the project management of risks. Very important to set this process in place at the time or before you start the implementation of the project. So for example, these are the typical project risks. A construction project, what could be the risk? Technical failures. Second could be raw material availability such as cement or steel. Recently, for example, the government banned mining of sand, which is an important raw material for construction projects. Hence, a number of construction projects were held up due to lack of sand availability. Then third risk could be price increase of key inputs. Take for example, construction of roads. Risk could be unexpected rains, storms and floods, or there could be resistance from local people who may lose their property because the road is coming up. A software project, what are the possible risks? It could a new technology, will this work or not? Then customer resistance to new technology or using or adopting to new technology. Implementation difficulties. Then software bugs. Scalability of solutions. So these are some of the risks that are associated with a typical software project, just to give you an idea of what could be the possible risks that we are typically dealing with. Then, for example, if we have a new product launch, what could be the risk? So one could be market response, or will the product be accepted by the by the customers. The second risk could be delay in launch, reducing the first mover advantage, and maybe competition launches that product before us. Okay, so competitor launching a similar product before us could also be a risk. A shipbuilding project, is the design of the ship correct? You know, will the ship be okay when it is, you know, put into the sea? Delay in raw material, part supply, labor strikes, cost escalations, which could be possible risks in a shipbuilding project. The next important area of project management is the resources required for the project. Now, this typically comes in what is called the four M's, which is men, material, machinery, and money. Now, all these resources are required in different points in time, depending on, you know, at which stage of implementation, which kind of resources is required. Some men could be required at the beginning, some more skills could be required at a later stage. Machinery could be required at different stages of the project. Material is required through and through. Money is required through and through. It is important to plan the, you know, the use of all this on a month-to-month basis, so that we are never short of any resources, and you know, we don't delay the project implementation time as a result of that. So when project schedules are made, a resource schedule also needs to be prepared to be able to support that project schedule to completion. Now, resource planning aims to align the resource requirements of the project within the project deadlines and project timelines, and prevents resources from either being underutilized or overutilized during the life cycle of the project. Each project will have what is called a critical constraint. It could be a very expensive piece of machinery. It could be a critical skill that the project needs. So, for example, a robotic arm could be a critical constraint, or a Java programmer, or a blockchain programmer could be an example of that. So, planning of these resources in terms of careful scheduling based on delivery, availability, project timelines is called critical chain scheduling. And in advance, you should identify all the critical constraints so that, you know, you are not stuck at the critical moment or at the moment when the project requires these resources. In terms of the next element after resources is project planning. Now, planning a project means different thing to different people. For some people, a project plan is a complete project charter and complete project management document covering the project definition, the management chart, the organization, quality plan, change control, the PERT CPM chart, the implementation schedule, the budgets, estimates, costs, everything. To some other people, a project plan is basically just an implementation plan as to when the project will start and when the project will end, or when each activity within the project will start and within when each activity within the project will end. So for them, this is typically what a project plan is. So project plan means different things to different people, but typically project planning is different for large projects and small projects. A small project, may not require a big documented approach, a back of the envelope, or a small, document outlining how the whole thing will be managed may be sufficient. Whereas for a large project, planning is required, in-depth planning is required, a lot of thought and process, thought has to go into the planning process to ensure that we deliver within a quality project within time and cost budgets. So this requires a lot more planning. Typically, the project planning covers the following. It covers the purpose and the goals. It gives the calendar and schedule. It gives the work products to be delivered. It gives the work breakdown structure, which will make up the work products. It will set the individual tasks that need to be performed to achieve the work products and therefore overall project goals. It will identify the risk associated with each task, and it will give you the task dependency, which means what is the sequence in which the tasks have to be performed, and the start of which task depends on the completion of which previous task. So typically all these things are there. Then the processes needed and the standards required to ensure what are the quality of deliverables we are looking at. It includes the quality control plan. It requires the schedules or people that are required with the skills and the cost at the right time, then material and other resources like equipment and documentation, training and implementation activities, all these things are a typical part of the project plan. So keep this in mind when making the plan for the project. Next comes the project execution. Once the plan is ready, the next job obviously is to jump into the execution of the project. Now, this is the most important part of the project. Till such time the execution has not started, everything is conceptual. Now, real ground activity is beginning to implement and real money is going to be spent on this project. Okay? So, it is important that all the activities are properly scheduled and controlled. During the execution phase, the planned solution is implemented to solve the problem that is specified as the objective of the project. In product and system development, a design resulting in a specific set of product requirements is created and the conversion is measured by prototypes, testing and reviews. Very important part of this thing. As the project execution progresses, different groups across the organization get activated and involved in the overall project and in planning for the final testing and production and support. The most common tools or methodologies used in this are the update or risk analysis and scorecards, in addition to business plan and milestone reviews or project reviews. So this is the project execution stage. The next stage is, the key points of a project execution plan are the project plan. Then you have a detailed work schedule in terms of PERT CPM charts. Then you have the breakdown, the work breakdown structure, which gives you the work products. Then the drawings, designs and the working instructions, the tools and the equipment, material and other resources, lists of tasks to be performed before starting another work product, then assignment of people to tasks with the right role, responsibility and authority, production and productivity norms, absenteeism, breakdowns, review mechanisms and the methods by which we can motivate people, budgets for keeping them motivated, travel budgets, many people in projects work overtime, so how do we compensate for them and so on and so forth. The last thing that we have to look at once the project is under execution is the project tracking and review mechanism. Now, every project, once it starts, needs to be reviewed at a periodic interval to assess what is the development and what is the progress that we are making on the implementation of the project. Okay? Now, they can be reviewed on the basis of PERT CPM chart or the project plans that have been submitted in advance. So it gives us an opportunity to check actual versus plan, to see, detect slippage, understand the factors that are causing the slippage and take corrective actions. Reviews and milestone reviews are done at different points of the project so that we understand whether we are achieving the desired outcome or not. A review undertaken at a milestone will generally undertake a complete stock of the entire project till date, will involve management and sponsors along with the project team and may create a revised project plan if there has been a slippage in the key milestones. Reviews can also have a more specific agenda. For example, there could be attrition of key people or there could be a sudden increase in the cost of certain raw materials. Okay. All these things could also create additional meetings and reviews to take stock of the situation and change it. Now, quality of the project documents, quality of MIS, that measures the progress of the project is very important in the tracking and review methodology. If the MIS is incorrect and the MIS is not on time, the managers managing the project will not have enough data to be able to take any corrective action. So just as planning is a way of getting in control, planning is a way of getting in control, tracking is a way of staying in control. So both go hand in hand to ensure that the project finally delivers on its goals and objectives. That ends our session on key definitions and frameworks, etc. Thank you so much for your listening pleasure. I hope it was insightful for you. Thank you once again.